Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan, read the paper on October 7th, 2018.
Right. So, just to show we're current, it's not like we are not completely unmindful of current events.
Yeah.
But we're not completely into talking about it either. So, with respect to the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, there were...
Oh, I thought you were going to talk about the Giants' loss today.
Oh, God, it's
Dan is reeling.
I'm reeling.
I'm surprised he can even speak.
Well, we'll find out. We'll find out if I can speak. A lot of bad referee calls. Well, let's put that aside. I don't want to get a fine.
Well, you should tell people how it ended out.
It ended with us watching a game with 6 seconds go, and the other team, the Panthers, lined up to try a game-winning field goal from 64 yards. And then the station cut away to an advertisement. And we never saw the field goal attempt, though I found out later that the Panthers had made a 64-yard field goal and the Giants lost. So that gives you the frame of mind that we're in. Now, having said that, going...
You can see when he's really upset.
Yeah.
He...
Speaks clearly.
Well, he goes back to his native tongue, that New York fast-talking...
Oh, that's the native tongue?
Yes.
Okay. All right, so Brett Kavanaugh. We're not talking about Brett Kavanaugh, but we're going to...
But everyone else is.
Yes, but we're going to talk about the way the Wall Street Journal didn't talk about Brett Kavanaugh, at least when it was off the front pages and in the feature pages. And they had a couple of, slants on this. One may be humorous, the other one a little less so. But the first one about beer. Beer being a big theme, apparently, of Brett Kavanaugh's youth.
Yes, well, there's an article in the review section of the Wall Street Journal under the historically speaking category by Amanda Foreman. She sums it up. I'll go to the end of the article first. As we've seen recently in the Kavanaugh hearings, a male-dominated beer-drinking culture can be unhealthy for everyone. Perhaps it's time for brewers to forget the king of beers, Budweiser's slogan, and seek their once and future queen.
Once and future being the key phrase, because it turns out beer, at least in its origins, was very much female-oriented.
Apparently. Now, you know that beer goes way back. I always bring this up.
Always.
I often bring it up.
Often bring it up.
Because in Sumer, where history began.
Right.
People were drinking beer back,
exit
3,000 years.
Exit 8 on the turnpike.
BCE. Sumer.
Yeah, right.
In the Middle East.
Yes.
In modern-day Iraq. Almost 40% of their grain production was devoted to the making
40%,
of beer.
40%. And believe me, grain production was big.
And the oldest known beer recipe comes from a Sumerian hymn to the goddess of beer, composed around 1800 BCE. The fact that a female deity oversaw this most precious commodity reflects the importance of women in production. Okay, beer was brewed in the kitchen and was considered as fundamental a skill for women as cooking and needlework. Then they also mentioned the importance of beer to the Egyptian culture.
Right.
Okay. We know all this from what was found in the tombs, etc. And the exception to the ancient culture's fascination and devotion to beer is, of course, the Greeks and Romans, who preferred wine.
Right.
It's noted that there is no mention of beer in Homer.
Right.
Okay. Homer as in the Iliad and the Odyssey, not Homer Simpson. I think he does mention beer.
He does.
That's
irony.
So Northern Europeans adopted wine growing from the Romans, but beer was their first love. The Vikings imagined Valhalla as a place where beer perpetually flowed. Still, beer production remained primarily the work of women. And it's not until beer becomes thought of as a profit-making venture that women lose out and men start taking over production of beer, okay, and which is around the 15th and 16th centuries. As professional male brewers took over production and distribution, women lost their respectability. By the 19th century, women were far more likely to be tempers than drinkers.
Complete switch, yes.
Okay, so...
But here we are now, and beer post-war came back initially, post-prohibition, post-war, The advertising was directed at women because they wanted them to use it for cooking.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But then it kind of caught on for drinking, too. And now I think women only account for 1/4 of all beer consumption.
Yeah, women are not really addressed in the commercials. Sometimes they're undressed in the commercials.
Well, that's the point.
But the commercials don't seem to be trying to entice women to drink beer.
So there is the humorous, I think, suggestion in the Wall Street Journal that perhaps some social mores might change if women were to invest more heavily into beer as history had them invested. But in terms of a more serious, somewhat remote, but I think serious, focus on the issues, but again, an oblique one, is an article that's written by a fellow named Gerard Baker of the Wall Street Journal. He is an editor at large. And he writes about an exchange, very almost unhealthy, certainly disagreeable exchange between a newspaper writer and college senior writing for her paper about the Kavanaugh hearings. And he writes about it at some length, and it turns out it's really a story of him and his daughter. So he's extremely sensitive to the differences people have with respect to the Kavanaugh hearings. But in the latter part of the article, he finds something in the way of consolation in the upcoming movie called First Man, which is the movie about Neil Armstrong, the first man to land on the moon. And the observation...
Well, this sounds like a huge leap.
Well, let me explain why. No, it's not so huge. He makes an observation which, I think there's something to it, but I'm not going to dwell on it. But, you know, the... moon landing was in 1969. There has been no more controversial, disagreeable, upsetting period in my mind in American culture, the vision of Americans than 1968, not now, 1968, where you had the civil rights differences. You had the assassination of Martin Luther King. You had the assassination of Bob Kennedy. You had the Vietnam War. You had Johnson not being able to run for re-election. You had Nixon against Humphrey. The country was going crazy. And, of course, all that crazy rock music besides, which was being introduced. And it's just the very next year, 1969, to do with the moon landing. And the way Baker takes it, and there's something to it. We were around. Is that the country was able to put aside its differences for some time, at least, to focus on this monumental accomplishment by the United States of America, the moon landing. And he's not suggesting at all that the movie is going to unite the country. Of course it won't. But what he's getting at is that, he wonders, if there's some other event that could come up that would galvanize the nation in a different way, from left field, if you will, in the way the moon landing did. And, of course, we're looking forward to that movie, which is supposed to got excellent early notices, First Man, supposed to celebrate what a great accomplishment it was and the effect on the country. Interestingly, there was an article in the Science Times this week about Neil Armstrong's sons. Neil Armstrong, of course, has passed away, who are now auctioning 3,000 items of personal memorabilia of Neil Armstrong. Mm-hmm. And some of them, maybe you want to buy them. I don't know, Tamsin. But apparently, astronauts do this kind of thing. Often when they're retired, they sell off memorabilia. Neil Armstrong didn't. So it's all been in his garage. Mm-hmm. And they said, maybe we should set up a museum, or maybe we should preserve it in some way. And the way they describe it is, if we sell it off, the people who pay for it will preserve it because they spent a lot of money for it. So it's a good thing. Mm-hmm. Maybe mm-hmm. It's fine. The items, the memorabilia, a lot of it is material that he took to the moon. He tucked away in the spaceship.
Uh-huh.
And
really?
Then he took back home. And that includes a flag of the United States, which is expected to go for $300,000. It includes a flag of Purdue University, where he went to school. Was this expected to go for some fair bit of money? But they also had some interesting comments about growing up with their dad, and who they found a little bit imponderable, as maybe every son finds their dads. But, they had kind of, in some ways, a modest, quiet life, except they would do things like go on vacation in Acapulco, because Neil Armstrong was, guess what, a pilot. And he would fly into Acapulco once in a while for vacation. But he was also kind of oblique, kind of in his own world. He was very limited in his communication. Apparently, that's a big theme in the movie. He was limited. He never made a lot of money, either before or after. As a matter of fact, they said that astronauts could not get life insurance. And the way they would cover themselves.
Because if you're going to do stuff like fly to the moon.
Yeah. No, because it was dangerous. And in fact, what the astronauts used to do before they went on these missions was they would autograph commemorative envelopes that remained on Earth that the family could sell in case something happened.
Wow.
If you can imagine that.
But I think you described him to me as someone who liked to figure out how things work.
That's right.
And, that, and that's really what
Ryan Gosling commented on that.
Oh, okay.
In terms of his thinking. But Armstrong was, you know, they talked to him after he came back. These are the sons. And they said, what did you talk to him? He just came back from the moon. He said, you know, what have you guys been up to? Are you helping your mom? Are you mowing the grass? You know, that kind of stuff. That was their conversation with him. He later, he bought a farm. He sort of stepped out of public life, although he was never very much in it. And he applied for and was rejected when he tried to get a Diners Club card. Anyway, the way the sum it up is that one of them says, this fellow Rick, says, I pretty much learned quickly that I wasn't going to be able to be something that would compete with him. I wasn't going to be the first man on Mars. So that about sums it up. And they came to some kind of rips of the way their father was and that they didn't have to compete with him. And he was a quiet, odd guy. So anyway, we're looking forward to the movie, First Man. And it is a little bit of a reminder that the country jumps around. But on the other hand, there are things that have nothing to do with politics, as many good things do, that sometimes do unite the country going forward.
Wonder what that will be.
Yeah.
Article in the Wall Street Journal about Scrabble, okay, by Jonathan Kay.
Yeah.
And why would anyone play a game that's all about memorizing obscure words and makes you feel stupid when you lose? Okay, so this is a guy who's wild about tabletop games.
But not Scrabble.
A passionate board gamer,
yeah,
he says. And there's a renaissance going on in tabletop games. Did you know this? I mean, we sort of know this because
we have
tabletop gamers in the family.
Tabletop gamers.
We have actual relatives who hold game night. And we actually have dear friends.
Don't be ashamed.
Dixon has game night, too.
Does he?
Yes, he does.
Well, I know that Zeke does. And Zeke's is more. I think of him as more than a relative.
They play different.
He's his son. He's our son.
They play different kinds of games.
Yes.
But we are surrounded by tabletop gamers, I think.
Surrounded. We're surrounded. So,
but I didn't realize that there was anything wrong with Scrabble. He says, it galls me to see so many gamers stick with Scrabble during the current renaissance in tabletop games, which began with Settlers of Catan in the 90s and shows no sign of letting up. There are many other better gaming options out there. And what he points out is that there are all kinds of games. He says, what turns my crank doesn't have to turn yours. But amid this cornucopia, certain general principles do apply. One of them is that a fun beer and pretzel game night game should have some mix of skill and luck. Backgammon, which I don't play. Do you play backgammon?
No.
Is a classic example, as are most popular card games. A game that's all luck and no skill, like Snakes and Ladders or Unicorn Glitter Luck, on the other hand, is suitable only for small children. A game that's all skill and no luck, like checkers and chess, which I know you do play, is going to be less popular among couples and friends than at dedicated clubs where players can sort themselves by skill. Okay.
I thought it was Chutes and Ladders. Is it not Chutes and Ladders?
He says Snakes and Ladders, but maybe that's a...
Okay.
Maybe he just...
Shows you how little I know.
Maybe it's a copyright thing. I think it is... Well, it's Chutes and Ladders. Who knows? But anyway. And he suggests trying out what he finds are great games like Codenames, which is some kind of spy master game, or Paperback, in which players take the role of novelists trying to make a deadline. These sound awful, But so do most great movies when you describe them. You know, you're not interested in them. So yeah, I don't think the descriptions do them justice. He says, both feature a good mix of luck and skill. Scrabble, by contrast, involves just enough luck to disqualify it from the most exalted realms of mind sports. The vast memorization requirements mean that beginners will always be humiliated by veterans. And he does point out that some of the best Scrabble players in the world don't even speak English. Okay? They have just memorized the words. Okay? So
so we have to look elsewhere.
He sums it up by saying, referring to a good friend of his who loves Scrabble and mentioning that we are tabletop besties. Which is an expression that's kind of cute. Never heard it before.
Well, listen, I take that. Obviously, it's odd to find a rant against Scrabble of all things in the newspaper, but I take it as really a testament to this fellow's belief that the tabletop games are great and people ought to sort of widen their horizons, which again goes back to Zeke, who I think is going to be a huge impresario in that area.
But I do take his point that it needs to be a nice mix of luck and skill.
Right.
Because I would not be in the skill department.
Well, it depends on the game, Gary. On the game. All right. So going back to having given a plug to First Man, going back to upcoming plays and movies.
Here's a play I'm not looking forward to. But maybe you are.
Okay? Well, I don't know.
And maybe many listeners are.
Okay, it's called Girl from the North Country, and it is a compendium of Dylan songs that are placed in the context of a newly written play. And some would use the phrase, the somewhat negative connotation of jukebox musical, and therefore would have said, gee, who needs another jukebox musical? Especially, you know, written by some over-the-hill, nasal-twanged folk singer. The answer is, according to Ben Brantley, we all do, because he thinks it's great. I should say that when I say the songs are placed in the context of a play that's written around them, it's placed in that context by the writer and director, Connor McPherson, who's a very well-known playwright. We saw The Weir that he wrote years ago. Uh-huh. Brantley thinks he's the best English-speaking playwright there is. So it's not like they got anybody to write a play.
But his plays are usually on the dark side.
They are on the dark side. So he writes a play that takes place.
That's what I want to go to. A dark play with music by Dylan.
Just put your hold back for a second here. But, you know, I know you're ready to jump into this. But the point is, it takes place, we should give the setting, in a Duluth, Minnesota boarding house. Many people know that Dylan is from, I think it's Hibbing, Minnesota, but he's from Minnesota. And that's why I'm sure they put it there. It has quite a cast of people, including Steve Bogardus, who you know from school, and in other productions. Mayor Winningham, who was a well-known actress at some time, a little less so now, but certainly has been around. A bunch of other people, even Robert Joy, who we saw in, what's it called again? The one about the twins.
Sideshow.
There you go. He was the star of Sideshow. He's one of the stars of Sideshow.
Sideshow, a great play.
Well, let me tell you.
An unappreciated play.
I can see you don't want me to go on about this, so I'll just say this.
No, you can go on about it all you want.
No.
I'm taking
a lack of enthusiasm, but let me just say this. He goes, after setting the stage and explaining the story, which is probably a little complicated even to read about it, but here's what Brantley says, and I'll just read this. After noting individually several songs which he thinks make an enormous impression, he uses very high praise for them, he then closes this way. He says, the show's most heartbreaking moments are perhaps its happiest. I'm thinking in particular of the jubilant performance of You Ain't Going Nowhere that begins the second act. It's performed as a sort of hoedown celebration, with dancing that defines each participant as an idiosyncratic individual, and as part of a synchronized whole. You may find yourself thinking that this is as close as mortals come to heaven on earth. And for just a few infinitely precious moments, a radiance eclipses the all-devouring night.
Well, when I read that review, I thought maybe I would like to go.
Okay. That's it. You know,
but on the other hand,
I think
you have read other reviews that were not quite so
positive. I have.
So, but for you, Dylan...
No, I don't think so. I actually don't know if it's for Dylanites, honestly. I think the arrangements are probably quite different than Dylan's. And I think it's more for people who enjoy group singing, community singing, almost hymn-like deliveries of songs. I think that's what it's about. And I think it probably comes across. You're right. I saw another review in particular, Vulture.com, but they didn't fight that. What they said was they found it too serious, too somber, too one note, which is a little different thing than saying that the songs didn't come across. I'm sure they do. But in any event, you were going to talk about a movie.
Well, I'm wondering about this movie, Beautiful Boy. It is based on a couple of books, a couple of memoirs. Beautiful Boy, A Father's Journey Through His Son's Addiction by David Sheff, and then Growing Up on Methamphetamines by the son, Nick Sheff. So it's a movie that's starring Timothée Chalamet and Steve Carell. So it's got me, you know, curious and thinking, mainly because those are two pretty good actors, I think. And I'd be, you know, surprised if it's not a pretty
ambitious
production.
I didn't realize you were a Steve Carell fan.
I wouldn't go so far as saying a fan. You know what's sticking in my head?
What?
In the movie that I can't even remember the name.
The one that we thought took place on Block Island?
No. All right, moving right along. We should have discussed this earlier.
All right.
I'm really talking more about Timothée Chalamet.
Timothée Chalamet. The last scene of that movie, Call Me By Your Name. Call Me By Your Name.
Right, with the father.
Right.
And so if it anywhere comes close to creating kind of a relationship between two characters...
Mm-hmm. It was Michael Stolberg was the father in that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. No,
there's no reason to think that. It's just, you know, I'm just curious. It may be a complete disaster.
Yeah, look, I've heard pretty good buzz about the movie. I think that it's obviously a compelling subject. You know, Chalamet got nominated in a lot of press. I do actually think Steve Carell's a good actor. So it could be interesting. I'm with you. Okay, baseball. A lot of people think this time of year baseball means baseball playoffs and baseball World Series. But what it really means more than anything...
Well, it does mean that a lot because you're making me watch all these games, you know.
But you know what else
And
is...
your teams are always losing, I must say.
Well, they're not in
it's
it.
It's like you should just not turn it on. Maybe these guys would have half a chance.
What I was going to say was what happens this time of year as much as anything is that baseball managers get fired. That's right. And it is kind of interesting. People kind of lose sight of it because they go right to the playoffs and World Series, and this goes under the radar. But in just a few minutes after the baseball season, you had the firings of John Gibbons, who had two different terms as the manager of the Blue Jays. Paul Molitor, who is the manager of the Twins, Buck Showalter, the manager of the Orioles, and Mike Socia, who's the manager of the Angels. These are pretty well-respected, established managers. Socia was the manager of the year twice. Buck Showalter was voted manager of the year three different times. Paul Molitor was voted the manager of the year in 2017, just last year. And I guess these guys all forgot to manage this year because whatever they knew about managing went out the window.
Do you think that's true?
No, of course not. Of course I don't think it's true. So here's what's going on. It's a couple of things. There is the notion of people are too old-fashioned. And we have the new quantitative.
Right.
So here's the quote. I mean, Mike Socia was the dean of managers in the major leagues 19 years. He was the manager of the Angels. And the general manager said when they let him go, what we're looking for in that next manager has connectivity with the players. We're looking for someone who can think with a probability-based mindset. We're going to look for someone that's eager to grow and evolve.
So it sounds like they're just looking for more touchy-feely guys who can do with a little bit of tech.
A little bit of tech who will do what the general manager wants him to do when the statistical guys say...
And to be buddies with the players.
Which is clearly the trend.
No more tough love.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, that's clearly a trend. And the other reason they fire the managers is because when your team does poorly, you know what's less expensive than cutting the team? Firing the manager. So, it's the kind of thing that gets the fans all excited. Oh, we have a big, turning point here. We got a new guy in. It's the same players. It's the same team. But it gets people hopeful for a few months, and that's what it's about.
Okay, well, I'm sad for them and their families, but I guess they'll get other jobs.
These guys,
right?
I think Showalter, folks like that will just retire, but whatever. Go ahead. You had, something about learning, I think.
Learning.
Yeah.
Yeah, just a little opinion article by Daniel Willingham, a professor of psychology at the UVA, and also the author recently of The Reading Mind, a cognitive approach to understanding how the mind reads. And he does a little article about learning styles. He starts out saying, you must read this article to understand it, but many people feel reading is not how they learn best. They would rather listen to an explanation or view a diagram. I know this is true because I have many students who don't bother with the reading wait for a certain teacher to give them the explanation.
Right.
Okay, so I assume they've analyzed themselves and saying, this is how I learn. There's no point in doing
the reading. There's a lot of self-analysis behind that approach.
A lot of self-analysis. But what he states is there's no real scientific evidence that there are these differences and that they actually mean anything. They have tested people who say that they are visual learners, and they have compared them, you know, learning some information in several different methodologies, and none of them are conclusive. None is superior. Okay. So there's no basis for that. Non-readers, go back and read the book, please.
Right, please,
but then
right.
there are other theories about categories of learning, etc., that come into play here. And one is about solving problems, whether you like to solve problems intuitively by analyzing them, for example, or whether you like to solve problems intuitively or by analyzing, whether you like to tackle a complex idea with an overview or diving into the details. And it turns out it's not about you and what you're good at. It's about the problem, okay? The problem is that trying to learn in your style doesn't help. It can cost you whatever your purported style. Intuitive thinking is better for problems demanding creativity. Reflective thinking is better for formal problems like calculations of probability. An intuitive thinker who mulishly sticks to his supposed learning style during a statistics test will fail. So what he's doing here is kind of encouraging you that you can, you know, adopt the style appropriate to the task, and that this is available to everyone, that science proves that, no matter what your personal prejudice is, that you really could take it on. Any type of learning is open to any of us. And he actually exhorts parents not to go in and tell your child's teacher that she is struggling in class because the teacher is not conforming to her learning style.
Well, look, this reminds me a little bit of Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow, which is the book that the Nobel Prize was given for. And there are two different styles of thinking. It's a little bit of a different construct of what you described, but not terribly different.
Right.
In that you have intuitive thinking, which is based on brain muscle memory, and you have more deliberate thinking, which you go back to first principles. And part of what you want to learn to do if you want to be a more effective thinker is consciously decide which mode of thinking is most appropriate under the circumstances. Because it's not as if quick thinking is not valuable. It is.
Right.
And
right.
Your instinctual reaction is worth a great deal.
Right.
But you have to make the judgment as to when you need to go back to first principles.
Yeah, he is not demeaning either style. He's just saying, it's available to all of us, and it really depends on what you're trying to do, what problem you're trying to solve.
Yeah. Okay, so, well, this is related to thinking and actually working here. There's an article on the front page of a section of the Wall Street Journal called Far From the Madding Coworkers. In our always-on culture, colleagues text and email at us at all hours, expect a quick response. But can you ever happily be out of reach and not out of a job?
Is this just another rant about technology in our lives?
No, it's not a rant, because actually it's a real problem. And that people do get texts and send texts, more to the point, expecting or half expecting a quick response. And the question is, how do you navigate that? I have my own approach, but I'm mindful that perhaps I'm a little more senior than some other people who feel it's harder to design their own approach.
I always say I could never survive a marriage to a lawyer in this day and age.
Well, because people
People are on call 24/7. Imagine trying to raise a family and having a family life when you could be called sort of into work.
So look,
any moment.
I will check my emails like every hour, every couple hours. I'm not on it all the time. But maybe I can get away with that. But the real point is, my point is this. First of all, a lot of things come up in this article. Number one, people send emails at all times and texts at all times. And a lot of them aren't worthy of response. And you have to take the attitude that they're not worthy of response.
And a lot of times they don't expect a response.
And a lot of times they expect an email.
They just want to
write. Even if they do.
You want to get it off your chest, you need to write the email.
So they give
an
example.
Get it in there.
They give an example. Urgently need approval of $12,000 expense report. Well, there's no such thing as an urgent need of approval for an expense report. There just isn't. Or as I've said to my assistant more than once, I don't work for accounting. Accounting works for me. Or can't wait until tomorrow for feedback. Well, actually, you can wait until tomorrow for feedback, it turns out. Really sorry to bug you at home. Can I take next Wednesday off? That will wait till tomorrow morning. So you have to be able to pick your spots, and you have to not worry about emails like that. On the other hand,
what if you miss something really important?
Well, can we jump on for a quick call to flesh out X and Y? We need to talk to Beijing. I mean, I think you have to know if you're on projects that for which there's some risk or possibility of those kind of things. You have to be sensitive to that and monitor email for that. But that's unusual.
Yeah.
That's rare.
Well, it's true for me too. Yeah. Because it used to be professors have office hours.
Right.
If you have a problem, you go during that specific time. You go to the office. But now with email, students can ask questions and have problems 24/7.
Well, what
and they often do. I try to explain to them, if you're going to contact me after 11 p.m., you're probably not going to get an answer. But so it's funny. We used to go from having specific amount of availability to students to, unlimited availability. But what I do try to check my email a little more frequently when there's a big assignment coming up and someone will need an answer.
If you have circumstances that you check it more often. There's no question about it. But there are people who have the phone within reach all the time. And they have one eye on the phone all the time. And you can't live that way. And what you have to recognize is that people will send you emails at all time, but that just tells you what their schedule is. It doesn't tell you what your schedule is.
Yes.
And it doesn't even presume, you shouldn't even assume that they expect a response at this time. There are some people who sleep till 10, get out, get to the office at 11, and they're writing you an email at 10:30. Good for them. That's not what I work. Okay? So that may have been the thought occurred to them at 10:30, and when I get into work the next morning, I'll respond to them. With the exception that you have some things that the timing is different.
Again, as you said before, easy for you to say. You're not at the beginning of this career curve, and you can see how, even though it's unreasonable, that people will be judged on their availability.
I will say this. What I do, and I think this is considerate, I'm sure I do many things inconsiderate, is when I write an email off hours to somebody asking them something, I will say, no need to respond. Or no need to respond. We'll talk tomorrow morning, that sort of thing. I will put that in the email because otherwise a junior person feels they have to respond at 11:30 at night. And usually they don't. But, the other side of it is you got to be available during office hours. And the fact that you're responding to emails at 11:30 is no excuse not to be there during office hours. All the more reason that you prioritize office hours and you find a way to create some space, non-office hours. Sometimes you've got to lay down rules. You've got to be clear with people. But I think people respect
that.
I
still think it's complicated.
It is complicated.
It's very complicated, especially if you're trying to...
Well, the journal purports to give some strategies, and I did read their strategies, and they're totally worthless. So that just tells you that...
See, there's no answer.
It's a difficult problem.
All right. So here's an interesting art discussion.
Yes.
Okay. Tracing the identity of a very... shocking, famous nude by Gustave Courbet,
mm-hmm.
okay, who who you might consider the one of the celebrated kind of bad boys of 19th century French realist painting. Okay, so the painting is The Origin of the World. Mm-hmm. All right. And it's a rather gynecological look at a woman's body. You don't see the head, you just, you know.
Nice way of putting it.
Nice way of putting it. Yes. Anyway, it's a pretty famous painting. You almost never, it's actually owned by the Musée d'Orsay now. Uh-huh. At one point, it was even owned by Jacques Lacan. Do you know of him? He's a famous psychoanalyst. He and his wife owned it. But anyway, it is, it's actually so shocking that when it was on display a few years ago at the Met in a big Courbet show, it was kind of around behind a wall. So you had to sort of work to see it. It wasn't, it wasn't in the big room front and center. Mm-hmm. So that was interesting. Anyway, there have been lots of speculations over who this was, since there's no face, right. That limits it. And finally, a man named Claude Schoppe, who was doing some work on a letters between Dumas and the writer George Sand, found some clues mentioning who this might be. And he sorted it out, and he kind of, he actually went back to the archival letter itself and found a kind of a misprint, mm-hmm. A mistranslation of one word, and was able to sort out that this was actually a portrait, you might say, of Constance Coigneau, a dancer at the Paris Opera, courtesan, mistress of rich men, companion of a celebrated composer, and at the end of her life, a rather well-to-do older lady who, you know, actually even supported the Paris Opera, was generous to her servants. She was a respectable woman. Mm-hmm. So she was the dancer of the 1850s with the Paris Opera. She got a lot of publicity, but a knee injury kind of cut short her career, and this wealthy Ottoman diplomat, Khalil Bey, who was famous for sumptuous soirees, gambling, and huge debts that eventually will ruin him, commissions this painting of her by Courbet. Now, interestingly enough, mm-hmm. I have seen this painting, and it is interesting. And it's linked with another painting called The Sleepers, I think is what they call it, or Sleep. And it's these two women, nude, mm-hmm. And it's rather evocative and intimates a lesbian relationship or encounter. It's very erotic. But there's another painting. Now, this The Origin of the World was painted in 1866. There's another painting in the Barnes. You know, remember the good old Barnes Foundation mm-hmm. in Philadelphia, yeah. Good old conservative Philadelphia, and how it moved from the outskirts into downtown Philly? Actually, there's a painting at the Barnes painted in 1864 that I've seen called Woman with White Stockings. And in this painting, it's the whole woman. It's a rather similar in many ways, but less objectifying, I would say. A little less, almost seeming a little less pornographic. That was painted in 1864. I'm just wondering if the wealthy Turk knew about this painting when he commissioned the portrait of Constance Coigneau, or if that was pretty much on the part of Courbet to interpret it that way. Anyway, it's a mystery that looks like it's now been solved.
All right, good.
But another mystery is the flavor Q.
Right.
Which you pointed out to me, an article in the New York Times from Taiwan, talking about how a lot of food is advertised, sold on the basis of having a great Q-grade.
Yeah, I couldn't figure that out.
It has
out,
Q. Yeah. In some cases, double Q.
And so what does that mean?
It includes tapioca balls,
right.
Oyster omelets, deep-fried sweet potato puffs.
Yes, it's Asian food, but the question is, what is it?
How do you describe it?
Yeah.
This mouthfeel so sought off after by local cooks and eaters alike. Slippery, chewy, globby. it's hard to describe.
But you see these restaurant facades, which have Q on the restaurant
and
facade.
Yes, they have it on the signs.
It's on the signs, yeah.
There are pictures in the newspaper of happy double Q balls, sweet potato balls, and there's no real way to explain it. But you've heard of bubble milk tea?
I have
the floating,
heard of it, yeah.
You know, the tapioca?
Yeah.
That has Q. If it has a good quality Q tapioca in it,
Q's not a separate ingredient. It's a characteristic of the food.
Right. It's like in, maybe you've heard of unami, this sort of savory taste in Asian food.
Right.
Or this writer refers to al dente in Italian cooking.
So it gives you a sense of the texture of the food and perhaps
But nobody can really describe it, but it is very key to selling Taiwanese food.
Really?
And they talked to, the article ends with talking to a purveyor and she says, it's simple. When you eat it, you will be in a good mood.
All right, so next time we're in Taiwan, we'll
look for
restaurants that say Q, or maybe even Chinatown in New York.
Or double Q. It would be good if we could come up with some double
Q. I bet they
Q
have food. That in Chinatown. I bet they have advertisements that say Q.
Can you really trust it? All right, so next time you're in the mood for something slippery, globby, and chewy.
Well. You're not selling it. All right, so that's all we have, I think, for this week for Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper.
This is Tamsin and Granger, I think.
And Dan Happy Hop. I think you're right. And we'll see you next week.